Okay, welcome back. And we are taking a fun walk along with Harry at just some of the hundreds of things that his group got to see and participate in during the tour that just concluded 2 weeks ago. All right, we are ready for our next photo, Maestro.
All right. excuse me. Let's see, where am I here? Yep, okay. Inside the museum, photo 9. This is a motor, an engine.
I thought you were going to take us back to tomorrow.
Oh, no, no. I'll do that on my own.
All right.
When we go there to eat lunch next year.
Right.
Anyhow, this is an engine from a downed Messerschmitt BF-109, sometimes called an ME-109. It had been shot down in air combat over Nuremberg, had laid in a field or swamp or was whatever. People didn't know about it, didn't care about it. And finally, a year or two or three ago, it started leaking oil. And so, of course, it had to be cleaned up. And so they went there to get rid of the plane. They donated this engine to Michael's museum.
Uh-huh.
And the pilot was still in his seat, still on duty, what was left of him.
I saw a video, or a picture story video, of that recovery, I think. And,
okay.
Very, very interesting. That's a V8 kind of an engine schematic.
Yeah, I think
correct?
It was a V12, but yeah, it's a V-shaped engine.
You see the V on it. And,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of our members who's now passed away, he was too close to Agent Orange, never made it to 51 years old. He was my son's godfather. He used to be up around this area, North Florida, in all the little towns. He'd be putting up wanted posters. He'd pay $500 to anybody who would show him where there was a downed airplane, because we had about 400 airstrips in Florida during the war years to train pilots, and they were losing planes all over the place. So he'd pay somebody $500. They'd show him where the plane was. He'd drag it up and take it to, he had a warehouse in St. Petersburg, rebuild them, and sell them for static displays.
Oh, wow. Fun.
Yeah.
Fun stuff.
If that's what you
history.
Like.
Digging around in history, yeah.
You bet.
All right. Okay, number 10.
Number 10. That's just one of the many, many, many displays in the museum. This, I guess, was an artillery flag. I'm not as dumb as I look. I saw them cannons, figured it's artillery. So
that was good.
I think this was from World War I.
Connect the dots, Harry. Connect the cannons.
Again?
I got it. Connect the dots. You did
good.
Yeah,
right. I think this was from World War I, which, that would indicate World War I with the blue and white striped medal on the tunic. But he's got stuff from the 30 Years' War all the way up to current staffing of military in Germany.
Uh-huh. Very good.
And
good destination
11,
spot.
Yeah. It's a great museum, but it's not open to the public. It's open by invitation only.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael's our friend, and so we're invited.
Mm-hmm. Very good. All right. Are we eating again here?
We're eating. We have to do that a couple of times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And this is at a really nice outdoor cafe. Well, I don't have to tell you it's an outdoor cafe. Just look at it.
See? That's one dot we don't need to connect.
Right. There you go. Beautiful weather over there. It was like in the 70s. Sunny, beautiful, outdoor. There, what did I have for? I had a high saliva. Three scoops of vanilla ice cream with hot raspberries poured over it.
God, you just don't slow down. You will not stop. Amazing.
Well, that's one of the four major food groups. Ice cream, cake, cookies, and sugary stuff.
Uh-huh.
Those are the four major food groups.
I got it. All right. Is that a stage back there, a covered stage?
I don't.
Just say yes.
Okay, yeah. If you say so, boss, that'd be the case.
It's a covered stage.
It's a covered stage. That's where Elvis Presley and Juliet Prowse were singing Wooden Heart. Not really, but it makes a good story.
Sei mir gut. Yeah.
Okay. You don't need me singing.
No, but I didn't say that.
Yeah.
Backside of the tribunal at Zeppelinfeld.
You got it. Zeppelinfeld. They call it Zeppelinfeld. It means Zeppelin Field. And because in the days of lighter-than-air travel, they had Zeppelins land at this huge, big field. And then once the Third Reich came to power, the NSDAP, they had this huge, big tribunal built. And the reason we're looking at the back of it, when they had a party rally there, the people would come in from the front part, hundreds of thousands of people, and they all had to pay to be there, except for the military, because they were ordered as part of the evening, which is one of the ways Hitler made all of his money, there plus the sale of Mein Kampf, which is the second best-selling book ever in history, second only to the Holy Bible.
To finance the political movement.
Right. Mm-hmm. And he was not a thief stealing all the stuff. That was Goering. He stole everything that wasn't nailed down. He even stole castles. So anyhow, you look to the left side of this picture, the raised portion. There's a door down at the bottom that says Eingang verboten, which we know means shark hunters are welcome. And he would get off a train at a station that's further off to the left of this photo. The station is still standing today, but it's no longer used as a train stop. The trains just come flying past. It's a restaurant where we normally eat, but Michael says it's been taken over by the new owners and the food is trash. Those were his words, trash.
Huh.
So anyhow, Hitler would get off the train there, come across this parking lot or whatever this is called here, and go in the door at the base of that tower. And once inside,
not having this, I just had a flash. So he got off the train and he went to the Zeppelinfeld.
Yeah, in the back of this,
for this enormous rally, and he did not see the hundreds of thousands of people until he walked out there to give his speech, essentially.
Much, yeah. And he came out the very top door in that little tower. He was the only guy allowed to use that door. And naturally, like most powerful speakers, you wait until 20 minutes after you're supposed to start speaking to let the crescendo rise and everything. And the way it was designed, he would come out of this door way up and come downstairs like he was descending from the clouds. And he would come up, then he'd come up three or four more stairs to the speaking platform like he's coming right into the midst of the people. This is the way it was designed. Very
smart.
Clever. Speer designed it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Albert Speer.
Yep.
Yeah, so he walked up, and all the while he's walking down and then up at the end, the roar must have been astonishing.
Oh, yeah. And he would walk slowly to, you know, build the excitement to a fever pitch. And all around the four sides, or the other three sides and the main side, they had flag towers all along the three sides, the two sides in the back. And at each flag tower, there were big structures. Of course, because that many people, you had to have bathrooms. So each one was a bathroom. But at the top was an air raid searchlight. And at the proper moment, they were all switched on. This is at night. And they would all shine straight up into the sky for maybe like a mile and a half, 2 miles up. And it made like a light cathedral. They really knew how to put together some excitement.
Wow. Wow. Well, it's show business, okay? It always has been. Big politics, big power. Sure, it's orchestrated. It's presented. Ultimately, it's just remarkable.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
On to number 13.
Photo.
13 is where he would come into from the backside, and that would be on the left side of this photo, one of those doorways. Mm-hmm. And this was the Golden Room, and it's exactly the same as it was back in the days of the Third Reich parties. And they would have receptions in there. And we go in there, and very carefully, we go all the way up past the offices that he used when he was there, all the way up to his door. That, of course, you can't go through because it's locked. And nobody goes through it except Hitler, and since he ain't around, the door stays shut. But only shark hunters get to do this.
And they had food and tables and hors d'oeuvres.
Yeah,
and
I would imagine that's what they had, mm-hmm. you know, to gather, you know, all the very important people.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Of
very
the day.
Good. Lots of Nuremberg sausages, too, probably.
Whatever, I don't know.
Number 14.
If you remember the pictures during the 1936 rallies and all that, 1929, et cetera, and they had two of these big braziers, this one and another one, on either ends of the tribunal and filled with oil or something, and blazing flames coming up, and it just mm-hmm. really, you know, harked back to the days of the pagan worships.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our friend Doug there with the crutch.
Mm-hmm.
This is Doug's second, Dag, D-A-G. This is his second year with us on
Doug.
This tour. Yep,
Doug,
D-A-G, like in Doug
right.
Hammarskjöld.
Yeah, another murder victim, but we won't go there. Let's
Could
see.
Be. This yeah, Doug and I have been working very closely on some of the air bases up in Norway where the big Ju-390 was flying in and out of. Before they took Hitler to the to South America, they were making flights to Japan, to the Kuril Islands, over the top of the Earth.
The polar route.
Yep.
Okay. So here we have a picture, an inset photo.
Yeah. And like I told you, I was a little bit rushed. It should not say the way it was 35 years ago. It should say the way it was 75 years ago.
Because I'm looking at the top, and I see the golden swastika up there, and that wouldn't have
right.
been 35
Plus you
years
also,
ago.
Right. You also see the structure that goes all the way out from the upper part to the end. Now, the end part, in the imposed, superimposed, on that end pedestal is where one of the braziers was, and the other one was at the corresponding
up
end.
Up at the top. Up
yep.
on top. There
yep,
it is.
Yep.
You can see it.
Right. And the other one would be to the right of that superimposed
yeah.
photo.
And you see the door, see the steps coming down from the door, and then
yep.
up at the end to the podium. That's what Harry was describing.
Right. And in the main shot that I took there, you see the door up there is the door Hitler would have come out. He would have been coming down the stairs, and I'm standing on the podium. So he would come down and then come up three or four stairs onto the podium.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But all those risers in the superimposed photo, the all the risers are gone from the main podium and the main structure all the way over to the end structure. That's all been blown up and taken away. Because in between each one of those vertical structures, they had a big 50 or 60 foot banner with a swastika on it hanging there.
That's you're talking about to the left of
yes.
the... All right, the main area where the door is at the top that Hitler
right.
would come out. To
yep.
the left, all of those columns all the way down to the end, that's all gone now?
That is all gone now, yep.
What fools.
Yeah.
And look at the brazier on the end. Okay, where's the
yep.
other brazier? Do we know? Was it?
Yeah, they just found it about 3 years ago. It was... It was in a city swimming pool, all painted up in psychedelic colors. It was a kiddie wading pool. But they've got it now. It's behind the big tribunal, but you can't see it from where we were. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. They are, by law, allowing everything to grow back there, so the platform or whatever you call it, the porch, all made out of stone. They got it's waist deep with weeds, and you waist high with weeds, and you're not allowed to kill them. So, I think maybe they're hoping that that nature will destroy it, because now the law says you cannot destroy anything built by the Third Reich, but there's no law that says you have to maintain it either, I guess. So just leave it alone and it'll crumble on its own. This structure, the tribunal, inside, it's all shored up with big timbers that are like 8-inch by 8-inch square, holding up the ceilings and everything. So how long is it going to stand?
Yeah. Look at that golden eagle on the top. Eagle, the swastika.
Yeah, with the oak wreath around it.
Yeah. Okay.
And one of the people, you know, we all saw the pictures ad nauseum of it being blown up. One of the guys I met with after the tour was over has a piece of that.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. All right. Number 16.
We went around to the other end of the Zeppelin Feld, and this is a shot of the tribunal, and you can see where all those vertical wings are all gone now.
Yeah.
And this is looking across the parade ground where all the troops would be standing at attention. It's boring as hell. I did that once or twice when I was in the Air Force. We had to stand while some colonel was making speeches that nobody gave a damn about.
Well, what a piece of history.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And you go there with shark hunters. Nobody else can get you in these places.
Yeah. Number 17.
17. This is
part of the Roman Colosseum, yes?
That's the Congressahalle, which means the Congress Hall, which was built kind of in the shape of the Colosseum, but you could put the Colosseum into this common area here and still have plenty of room. So this place was massive. A photo almost exactly like this appeared in our local left-wing yellow rag journalism called a Chronicle. We refer to it as Mulligan's Mullet Wrapper because the publisher is a guy named Mulligan and people wrap their dead fish in it. He posted this picture because he was in Europe just before I was there. The caption under this was Adolf Hitler's unfinished sports stadium. It wasn't Hitler's. It belonged to the party. It wasn't a sports stadium. It was an office complex. So I sent him an email and explained that, but he never published a retraction because me and him are not the best of friends. I sent him, about 3 years ago, he and I were on the phone together. I've known him for a long time. And we came to a disagreement. I told him what he could do with his newspaper, press and all. He didn't like that, so he sent me an email and told me I was forbidden to ever read his newspaper again.
Boy,
I don't know how you police that.
I hope you were able to overcome that.
Yeah,
grief
I know.
And
it took years of counseling. And
my God.
Right. I still laugh about it.
Yeah.
And he's losing subscribers left and right because when they, this used to be a very heavily Democrat county. Now there's very few Democrats here. Mostly it's all Republicans.
Nobody's reading papers anyway. Don't worry about it.
That's true. Print media is going away.
Reading is going away.
Yeah, that's true. So we're going to see about getting our books all on audio as well.
Well, that's quite an undertaking. You had a library and a half.
Well, we got 28 books in print already. Four more ready to go as soon as I get back from Argentina, and a whole bunch more that I can run up, including the one on this secret castle I was just at. That's my next priority.
Is the castle completely leveled?
Gone. Totally gone.
What a shame.
Yeah.
And, okay.
The dog run where Blondie was kept is also gone, but we have pictures of it.
Hmm. All right. More pieces of the puzzle. More pieces of the puzzle. Okay, next up, number 18.
18, right? 18, yep.
That's it.
Yeah, we're looking through a gate into the old city wall. There was kind of like a double city wall. If you broke through where we're looking here, then you had another city wall to try to attack. Nuremberg has the longest city wall existing anywhere in Europe. It's 5 point something or another kilometers long.
Wow.
And it's the longest still standing in Europe.
So those those, not the necessarily the red bricks, but the larger stones were put up there with some kind of masonry
yeah.
a long time ago.
Long time ago, yeah. Hundreds of years ago. That car was not part of the medieval fortress.
I wouldn't think so, no.
No.
Nice looking bronze color on that car, though.
Yeah.
Okay. Back in a minute. Hold on. Much more to see. Half an hour to go tonight. Tomorrow night, again, I'll take a little bit of a stroll with Harry through the rest of the photos we don't get to tonight. So we are at number 19?
19, 20? Yep. 19. That's another part of the old city wall. And if you look up above, you see there's living quarters up there. And
uh-huh.
that's where the soldiers lived. And there's a good incentive to make sure that the enemy army does not come through the wall, because it's your family that's going to get hit first.
Look at that. Wow. So that has to be 1400s, huh? Older, even.
Oh, yeah. The city of Nuremberg was, I think it was around 800 or 900 was when the city of Nuremberg was first recognized mm-hmm. on some type of a paper. I'm mm-hmm. not positive about that, but it's about 200-300 years older than Munich.
I think you had it in your paper first, didn't you? The Cooper Gazette in 857, was it?
Yeah, way back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Back in castle right. days.
Very good. Yeah, I could see you in a castle.
Yeah, easy. I would too, except it takes a lot of money.
Well, I didn't say live there. I just visit, you know?
Oh, well, I visit, yeah.
All right. Next up, number 20.
Yeah, 20 is just another shot of the old city wall.
Yeah.
But 21, that's an interesting one. What is that? It just looks like a utility cabinet stuck on the side of nowhere that
right.
nobody knows nothing, except it's got a big steel door. And if you look
Go ahead. Open
that yes. door. There's a lock right underneath the uppermost blue squiggle over on the right side. And then below it, just out of frame, there is another lock.
Mm-hmm.
And
what kind of lock are these? Hanging padlocks or key insert locks?
No, these are embedded locks, mm-hmm. and they're modern-day locks, as this utility cabinet is a modern-day addition. But once you open them doors, that door, we go into, I don't have any more photos of it because it was dark, but it's in another section of the city. You go down, I've got video on it that we're going to be posting as soon as I can flog Megan into getting it done. This is another modern-day bomb shelter, but at the far end of the modern-day bomb shelter, which is about 30, 40 feet underground, it goes into the old underground sewer and tunnel system under the whole city of Nuremberg from the medieval days.
Huh.
We did not go in there because we had a group. And
So this door leads into an underground bomb shelter.
Yep. And it leads into the old medieval catacombs.
Yeah. Nuremberg was founded in 1050.
Okay, there you go. Way back in the old days.
All right.
So these medieval tunnels, they're ancient and they're dangerous, so we're not going to bring a group in there. If I want to go in there, my friend will give me a tour, but you have to have camera and light in one hand and a small ball bat in the other hand because it's loaded with rats.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody goes there. I mean, they're left alone, and they run all underneath the city.
Right.
Friendly little beggars.
Yeah. Okay. Number 22, Africola.
Yeah, look at that logo. Incidentally, that's, I think, the biggest selling cola in Germany. Take a look at that
logo. What's the deal with the logo?
Okay. You're not familiar with the Africa Corps. If you remove the AFRI and put a swastika in there, it would look exactly like the logo on Rommel's Africa Corps. All his vehicles, everything had this. And if you look into, remember back to Indiana Jones, where they took the first Indiana Jones, where they threw his girlfriend into one of those trucks and drove away.
Mm-hmm.
That emblem was on it. I'm not saying they got this from Rommel's Africa Corps, but it just looks awfully similar.
Well, it's coincidences like that don't just happen.
I don't know.
Somebody had an idea. It's a little art. Stylized art.
Stylized art, and the Third Reich probably still owns the copyright on it, but who's going to come forward and create problems?
Mm-hmm. All right, number 23. This is a real interesting machine. That's a bomber.
Yeah, that's a HE-111. They built a lot of those things. Germany was never able to really get the big heavy bombers into construction, like our B-17 or B-24, B-29. You know, the long-range heavy bomb loads, or like the British Lancaster, could carry more bombs than any other airplane. But the Heinkel HE-111, one of our members, Baron George von Zirk, was a bombardier navigator on one of these things. He's passed on now. But he wrote us a lot of information about that, which we've put in some of our books. And in this museum where we go, this is in the hangars of a World War I Bavarian military flight school. Because there was no German Air Force in World War I. There was the Bavarian Air Force and various other air forces that were loosely connected until, you know, Germany came together as one major country.
Whose museum is this?
This is run by the Deutsche Museum, which is an incredible museum in Munich, but this is outside of Munich, on an old airstrip.
There are. I don't think there are many Heinkels left. I read a story. Everything was destroyed after the war.
Right.
They just cut them up, chopped them up, and recycled the metal, and that was it.
And yeah, that's right. And for instance, the Stuka dive bombers. I think there's only three left in the world. One is at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. I don't know where the other two are. P-47 Thunderbolts are very, very few of them because Eisenhower made the decision that the P-51s would be spared and all the rest would be scrapped out. P-38s, we'll see one in a little bit. There's only one operating in all of Europe, and in the U.S., I imagine you can count them on your fingertips. Awesome airplanes, but, you know, they're tools of war, and once the war is over, beating your swords into plowshares. What is that famous saying? Those who beat their swords into plowshares will plow for those who don't.
Well, that's a real true statement. No joke there. There are only two Ju-87 Stukas left. 6,000 were produced.
Right, only two left. Wow.
One is in a museum in Chicago.
Yeah, Science and Industry.
Yeah.
Okay. The one at the Museum of Science and Industry, about 20 years ago, they almost lost that because some dingbat that was in charge of maintenance or whatever screwed something up and it fell because it's hanging up in the air. And it fell.
The Stuka fell?
Yeah, it fell. So they had to put it back together and hang it up again. They've got it hanging in a bit of a diorama with a, I think it's a Hurricane or maybe it's a Spitfire, hanging behind it like it's coming in to shoot it full of holes.
Right.
Of course, in real combat, you'd be probably 50 yards or so away at least. Here, it's about 50 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
So if you open fire, you're going to be hit with all the pieces flying off the airplane. But it makes a nice diorama.
Well, they've got the thing there, and yeah, fine.
Yeah, at least they're maintaining it.
That's right.
24.
Number 24. Not many of those left either.
No, that was the ass kicker of the early days of the war, the Bf-109, Messerschmitt, sometimes called the Me-109. Now, at another museum that we are no longer able to visit because it's a top secret location, they have a Messerschmitt 109, and they fly it. They also have an Me 262 jet fighter, and they fly that.
Hmm. Wasn't there an effort to build half a dozen 262s to exact replica, but both modern components, some years
ago? Right, there was a guy in, I think it was Houston, they were building the Me 262 and also some FW-190 Focke Wulf.
Oh.
I don't know whatever became of that. That was quite a while ago.
Okay. Number 25.
25 and 26 are both, we were just talking about it, the Me-262, the first operational jet fighter anywhere. And they were vulnerable during takeoff and landing because they had to slow down and they were not all that maneuverable when they got slow, which is why they usually had FW-190s flying top cover for them. But once they got up and got going, nothing was going to catch them. They were 100 miles an hour faster than the P-51 Mustang. And Adolf Galland, General Adolf Galland, who was a member of Shark Hunters until his death, he said it was like the bombers were hanging on a string because these jet fighters were going 550 miles an hour and the bombers were only making maybe 180. So they were just flying through the bombers like they were hanging on strings.
He said when he flew the first time, he said it felt like, I forget what he said, that the angels were pushing him along. Yeah. Yeah, it's very strange to hear that kind of a statement. But,
They were so fast, nothing could catch them. I mean, they had no danger from behind. And they were so fast, deflection shooting wasn't going to work. And the only way anybody could shoot them down, other than takeoff and landing, was to catch them in heavy fire in the bomber formations.
Mm-hmm.
And that only by luck. One of our members, Urban Drew, whose first name was shortened up into Ben, he shot down the first two Me-262s that were taking off on a combat sortie. He had been watching this base develop, and when they saw the 262s ready to take off, he came down with his P-51, and the squadron commander and his wingman were taking off, and he gunned them both down. The wingman just blew up all over the place. The squadron commander either was high enough to bail out or he put the plane down and got out of it, so he and Ben Drew got to be buddies after the war years.
Oh, interesting.
But that's the only time they were vulnerable. You couldn't get them in the air. They were running way faster than you can go. And they use that body shape to develop the F-86 Sabre jet for the U.S. The rest of these were just airplanes in the museum. Number 27 is a MiG-15, which the Soviets used heavily in the Korean War. We had suspected at the time that Russians were flying them, and we have found out about 4 or 5 years ago, we ran a lot of articles, first-person articles by Russian pilots, that they were indeed flying them. 28 is a Phantom. Those things were ass kickers. They didn't have guns on them until later. They put a gun pod on them. They fired missiles, and that's not always the best bet.
That plane first flew, the F-4 Phantom, in, I think, 1954, if I remember.
Wow. That was a pretty solid aircraft for a long time.
They're still flying.
Yep.
They still fly them.
And Colonel Robin Olds used that to virtually wipe out the North Vietnamese fighter interceptors, the MiG-21s. They had, I think, 24 of them was all they had. And they wouldn't come up to fight with the Phantoms. They just were jumping the F-105s that were fighter bombers and, of course, hanging all that ordnance. They weren't that maneuverable, so they'd have to jettison their ordnance to get away or get shot down, so they wouldn't come up to fight with the Phantoms. So Robin Olds adopted a trick that you saw in the Black Sheep Squadron deal. They copied it for one of the films, one of the shows. Olds had his guys go up and fly at the bomber altitude, fighter bombers, and in a fighter-bomber formation at the fighter-bomber altitudes, and they'd be using the jargon that the fighter-bombers were using, and it finally worked. These MiG-21s finally came out of the clouds to fight with what they thought were unmaneuverable thuds, and he wiped out better than half of their interceptor force in that one battle.
First flew, first flight, May
27, 1958. Wow.
Like some Air Forces, I think, in the...
Go ahead.
No, I think some of the Middle Eastern countries still have some, and they do fly them. The Iranian Air Force was flying them. Yeah.
The problem they have there with any of them... Parts, that's right, maintenance. You got to keep changing parts, otherwise the planes don't work. We saw that when the Cuban Navy got three Russian-built Kilo-class submarines. They were working fine until they ran out of spare parts. Then they didn't dare dive them. A submarine that doesn't dive is pretty much a target. Number 29, that was the hottest bird in the Korean War, the F-86 Sabre jet.
Hey, 29.
Yep, F-86 Sabre jet. This is from the new Luftwaffe.
Right. That's quite
the
a
next
museum
one,
there.
Interesting. It's an awesome museum.
I've not seen one marked up like that, painted up with the modern German Luftwaffe markings.
Right. Well, they used them. And if you look at photo number 30, there's an interesting story there. That's a starfighter, F-104.
The Widowmaker.
Yeah, that's right. They had 292 of them crashed, and 150-something, I think, pilots went down with them.
Yeah.
And I was just wandering past the gift shop and the coffee shop there, and I was wearing my Air Force veteran hat, and one of the staffers came up to me, and thank God he could speak English better than my German, and we got to talking about the 104 Starfighter, and I mean, I was working on bombers, but I knew about the 104s, and we got to talking about, he was so excited, he literally grabbed me by the arm and dragged me back to the Starfighter here, because that was his baby. He took down the rope and put an access ladder up against the aircraft, opened the cockpit, pulled up the canopy, and had me sit inside this thing. And he gave me one of the helmets to wear. And Doug was up on a runner up above, and he's taking my picture. And this fellow unlocked all the control surfaces so I could actually step on push the rudder pedals and work the stick and the ailerons and the rudders, etc. We're all moving. Awesome.
Wow.
Awesome. And they still have that smell. The aircraft, military aircraft, all have a smell about them. No matter what military, it reminded me of my days working on the B-47s, loading hydrogen bombs onto the B-47s in 25 below zero weather. Yep.
No thanks.
Yeah. That was in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Yeah, that's too cold. The F-104 flew from 1958 to 2004.
Yeah. There was, we had an air show at our airbase one time, and it was a Saturday, and I was off duty, so I was out walking around on the flight line looking at all the fighters because I wanted to be a fighter pilot. Uh-huh. And the 104 came in. Holy cow. The thing was, they call it a missile with a man in it. And I was standing on the wing of a 102 showing the pilot how to put in his safety pins, and the aerodrome officer was down on the flight line in front of us, and we're talking about the 104. And then the aerodrome officer says, "There he is," and he pointed to the south, and there's a tiny smudge of smoke on the horizon, and all of a sudden, bam-o, this thing went overhead. Holy cow, and like 3 seconds later, you hear kaboom, the sound wave. And then he landed, and the next day he was getting ready to go, and I was helping him undo his safety harnesses and all that.
Uh-huh.
And he kept looking at his watch, and I said, "Where are you going, Captain? What are you in a rush?" He says, "Yeah, I'm doing it at O'Hare in 45 minutes. O'Hare's in Chicago. This was in Lincoln, Nebraska, 500 miles away. And he says, "I'm due there in 45 minutes. I said, "I think you're going to be late." He said, "Oh, no, I'll be early." 45 minutes to take off and go 500 miles.
Wow.
They released, I remember they released that this thing could hit Mach 2, which is like 1,500 miles an hour, and yet one set an altitude record of 103 point somewhere another 1,000 feet, and he was doing 1,600 miles an hour in a vertical climb. So if he's going 1,600 in a vertical climb, what's he doing straight and level? A whole lot more than Mach 2.
They didn't tell us.
No,
obviously.
Of course not.
Wow. It made 2,500 of them.
Okay. Most of them are sitting in museums, or else they're mothballed out at Davis-Monthan, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Sustained Mach 2, it could probably do 3.
I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Yeah. No, that was just one fast aircraft. Amazing.
Yep.
All right. We are just about out of time. We've been spending it with Harry on looking at photos of his just completed 2 weeks ago tour, his Southern Patrol. He'll be going back again next year, and you can go with him. There's much more ahead, and remember, we're only going to be able to see pictures of a relatively small portion of the destinations and locations that the tour goes on. Just great. All right.
Mark Hunter's at earthlink.net, and I'll send him information about the next tours.
Now, I have another hour to do, so why don't you go get your sleep, and I'll, you don't want to wait up for me, because it'll be
No, I'm not going to wait. I'm going to go look at the inside of my eyelids. Give me a call anytime tomorrow. I'll be here.
Talk to you then. All right.
Thanks,
Harry.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Okay, we'll be right back with hour three. More information today on the vaping crisis. Now, we're beginning to get an idea. I speak for Dr. Henry Nyman and others and myself that we may be closing in on what the general area of interest has to be in terms of finding out what is causing the deaths and the severely damaged people from vaping. So we're going to do that next. Hang on.